is the Good Glow Health, a podcast that will help us understand our health better. I'll talk to experts who will demystify topics like sleep, IVF, nutrition, gut health, and much more, as we take steps to become the healthiest version of ourselves. Since being diagnosed with cancer in my 30s, I made it my priority to educate myself on my health. I discovered creating healthy habits and investing in yourself can lead to wonderful things. I'm so proud to say that this podcast is sponsored by Emma. Emma mattresses are created by an in-house team of sleep experts who use only the best foams and the latest foam technologies. The Emma products are designed with you in mind and sure to have you waking up feeling energetic and refreshed. For a limited time, listeners of the Good Glow Health podcast can save a massive 42% on orders placed through emma-mattress.ie/podcast. Listeners from the UK can head to emma-mattress.co.uk/podcast to access their exclusive discount. You can find these links in this episode's description. My first guest on the Good Glow Health is Dr. Dearon O'Leary. I wanted to start this podcast series with a conversation about our general well-being. I wanted to ask Dr. Dearon all of those questions we forget to ask when we go to the GP. We talk about nutrition, blood work, vitamin D, what we need to do now to protect ourselves against COVID and the flu this winter, blood pressure, checking yourself, children's health, and how important it is to open up to your GP about anything that's bothering you. I learned so much from Dr. Dearon on this podcast, so I really hope you get something from it and enjoy it. Dr. Dearon O'Leary, welcome to the Good Glow Health. I am so thrilled to be sitting down with you today in beautiful Cork, and I have been following everything that's been going on in your life over the last couple of months, and how have you coped on the front line?
It's been really busy, an awful lot of changes to how we've worked, you know, in general practice. We have had to switch a lot of our work to telemedicine, doing telephone consultations, video consultations. Which is difficult. It's difficult for us as doctors, and it's difficult for the patients as well to adjust to that. We've had a huge amount of change in how we're working. So we're at my practice at the moment, we're doing telephone consultations first. So everybody's triaged over the telephone. If I need to see you, then we'll bring you into a dedicated face-to-face clinic. And we're wearing full PPE, which is, you know, it's so off-putting, and it goes against kind of everything I feel in my head what general practice should be, you know, that you know it's very, you're approachable and you're kind of in the community and you're able to communicate with patients, and it's in a very softly way, not a very clinical environment. So it's, you know, general practice has changed hugely since coronavirus kicked off, but you know, we're getting through it, we're getting there, we're adjusting to it, and it's a huge adjustment for everybody, but you know, we just have to kind of do the best with what we have and keep everybody safe.
I just wanted to say thank you for everything that you've done over the last couple of months, because I know that a lot of your followers would have gotten great comfort from your updates and you speaking about the importance of wearing masks and just keeping us very up to date and explaining things in basic terms. I think it's really important, and I think I will echo a lot of your followers in saying thanks to you for everything.
Well, look, I definitely don't think anybody needs to say thanks at all. Look, I've just been doing my job and I love doing it. I love what I do. And I suppose in terms of just putting, you know, basically like public health messages out and just kind of reminding people about the messages that we need to, you know, like physical distancing and all of that. But I think that like a lot of what I was saying was what was being said, you know, by public health advice anyway. But maybe coming from a person, like putting a face to it, as opposed to coming from like Department of Public Health or something, maybe people took a bit more comfort from it. I don't know. But anyway, there's no need to thank me because, you know, look, I love my job and I love what I do.
Do you feel like people are getting nervous about a second wave? You know, we're already into August. It feels like winter is just around the corner. Do you think people are starting to get a little bit anxious about what's ahead for us at the moment?
Well, there's, I suppose, two different groups of people. There are some people that are very anxious about reopening of society, and they've gotten very used to, you know, shielding at home, cocooning, physical distancing. And there's a group of people who don't want to see things kind of reopen. Numbers are kind of increasing again at the moment, over the last few days, and that for some people is very anxiety inducing. But then there's a group of people who, you know, want to get back to normal and want to get back to work and don't want this to continue. So it's, I suppose it's, there's very different kind of viewpoints on it, and different personality types. Some people are anxious. Some people just want to, you know, crack on and just kind of move forward.
As we come into flu season, and people will, I presume it's just natural to get a little bit sicker in winter than it is in summer. What do we need to be looking out for? And are we going to start to get confused over what is COVID and what is the flu?
I think I am anyway. You know, I think we all are, because it's going to be difficult to really tease out what's a common cold, you know, what's a sniffly nose. You know, common colds are caused by like other coronaviruses. They don't tend to have a high fever, don't tend to have a lot of muscle aches and pains or fatigue, you know. But then if you have flu, influenza, that, you know, there's high temperature, you feel like you've been hit by a train, you're stuck to the bed, you can't get out, you're exhausted, fatigue, muscle aches and pains. And then we'll have coronavirus, which is, you know, a kind of sore throat cough. It tends to be a dry cough as opposed to a productive cough, bringing up phlegm. But it can have so many different symptoms. It can have gastrointestinal symptoms as well, like vomiting or diarrhea, abdominal pain, fever, sore throat, wheeze. But again, while we have some things that make it easier to say this is more likely to be flu than the common cold, or more likely to be coronavirus than the flu, you can never really tell, because, you know, all of these symptoms overlap hugely. You know, they're all respiratory symptoms, for the most part. So with all of that said, the bottom line and the message is, if you have any of those symptoms whatsoever, so if you have, you know, a runny nose or a blocked nose or a tickly throat, or you know, if you're sneezing, even any of those symptoms, self-isolate, because it could be coronavirus, and call your GP. So then once you call your GP, discussing the symptoms that you have, how long you've had them for, hopefully you don't have them for too long, because the last thing we want to hear as a GP, you know, I've had a sore throat for the last 5 days. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not good, because that means you probably haven't been self-isolating and potentially spreading coronavirus. So call your GP, we'll get ordered the test for you. You stay at home, and you'll get the test. They're done now on the same day or next day, and you get the result within about, you know, 24 or 48 hours. It's a very quick turnaround. So you get the test done. If it's positive, obviously you stay and you self-isolate for a full 14 days, because you don't want to spread coronavirus. If it's not detected, then you can go back to work or school and kind of reintegrate into normal life within about 48 hours or when you're feeling well. So it's going to be really busy. It's going to be tough, because, you know, we would so often GPs would say, you know, yeah, take care of yourself at home, or just rest and fluids, paracetamol, vitamin C. You know, you don't need to see your GP if you just have a sniffly nose or a tickly throat. Whereas this winter, the message is different. It's that you have to contact us and we have to test you for coronavirus.
Okay, that's so clear and precise. Thank you so much. And talking about, I suppose, what steps we can take to protect ourselves coming in to winter, just to give ourselves a better chance of staying well, what would your advice to people be?
So there's a few things that we can do to make sure that our immune system is as strong as it can be this winter. So going back to basics again, you know, I know we're saying it till we're blue in the face, but it's important, you know, hand washing, hand hygiene is so mm-hmm. important, particularly before you're eating, because if there are bugs or germs on our hands and then we go to eat, we're putting them into our mouth, you know, infecting yourself. So washing your hands, physical distancing, getting sleep is really important for your immune system. Getting 8 hours of sleep a night is really, really important for your immunity. And vitamin D is proven as well to be really important for a good functioning immune system. There are vitamin D receptors on the cells in our immune system. So that's what I always recommend. If somebody wants to take something, vitamin D is a really good bet. So you don't have to get your vitamin D levels checked. But if you do want to, Your GP can do it. If you don't have the time to go and get your levels checked, just taking 400 units a day is considered safe for most people. So I like vitamin D, really important for immunity, sleep, hand hygiene, physical distancing, and the flu vaccine as well. So this winter, to help us get through this winter for flu season, the flu vaccine is going to be free for adults, or free for people from 6 months of age to age 69, if you have an underlying health condition. So if you have something like, you know, asthma, you'll get the flu vaccine for free for people from 6 months to age 69 years. People age 70 always got it for free anyway. And now this year also, we're going to have the flu vaccine for children for free age 2 to 12. And that's the nasal spray, which I think would probably be preferable for most children over the jab. So the flu vaccine is really important, and you can get it in your local pharmacy as well. So
absolutely fascinating, because I wasn't really aware of a flu vaccine for kids. I thought, you know, people over a certain age got it, or people with an underlying illness. So tell me a little bit about the flu vaccine in kids, and has this been available all the time?
It wasn't freely available here in Ireland, but this year, I suppose, coming into the particular winter season that we're facing, it's really important that we've herd immunity against influenza this year. So herd immunity is when enough of us are immune to a virus or a bacteria, so that it doesn't spread amongst the community. So the more people that are immune to the virus, the less it can spread from one person to the other. So, you know, children mix a lot. They're going to be going back to creche and school. So the more children that we can have to be immune against influenza, the better it's going to be for the general population. The more people that get the flu vaccine every year, the less likely we are to have, you know, flu outbreaks, increased hospital admissions, ICU admissions. So children getting it will really help with herd immunity and will help to hopefully keep hospital admissions down this winter.
And then I suppose if our kids are vaccinated against the flu, we're going to stop bringing the flu home and then potentially passing it on to older relatives who may end up in a bad way from it.
Exactly, because so many people say, oh, you know, I never get the flu, I don't need it, or my children never get sick, they don't need it, they're fine. But that's not what this is about. You know, this is about protecting vulnerable people who are frail and who might get very unwell or potentially even die from influenza. So that's what it's about. It's about, you know, those of us who can get the vaccine to get it to protect the most vulnerable and most frail in society.
Should we be taking vitamin D all year round? And is it really important for our kids to be taking it?
It's something that you definitely look. You can take it all year round. I take it all year round. I take 400 units. It has so many, you know, functions. Like particularly for women, for our bone health, helps protect us against osteoporosis, brittle bones, falls and fractures. And as I said, it's really important for our immunity as well. And absolutely, it's something that I would encourage for parents to talk to their pharmacists about. They can help you choose which one is right for your children. And you know, it's the sunshine vitamin, which we don't get a lot of in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I do encourage people to take it.
I remember when my husband Jamie was diagnosed with MS, and he was actually vitamin D deficient at the time. And I remember thinking, I was so shocked at that. But when we actually thought about it, Jamie had been driving into work in the dark and coming home in the dark, and he was really only seeing outdoors and sunlight at the weekends. So now he's really good at taking his vitamin D. My daughter Pia takes her vitamin D. I'm not so good at taking it, but I do take it from time to time. But it's such an interesting point that I suppose now is the time that we need to be getting ahead of ourselves and preparing.
Exactly.
Getting ahead,
you know,
of time.
Because I think that a lot of the time things can be reactive. You know, we can be in the height of the flu season, or somebody might be, you know, in bed sick with the flu or a cough or a cold, and then they want to start doing things, you know, they want to start taking something to make themselves, you know, boost up their system, whatever. But it's now yeah, to start getting into good habits. You know, sleep is so important, and managing stress as well. You know, stress management is really important for our immune system, you know, because stress will have a negative impact on our physical health as well. It has a negative impact on your immune system. So, you know, start working on things now and have a plan for how you're going to, you know, pace yourself for the winter ahead. It's going to be demanding psychologically for us all, you know, because we're all going to be, you know, children are going to be going back to school. That will be difficult for children and for parents, going back to workplaces which are different than what they were before. We'll all be working in different ways. There'll probably be still a lot going on in the news about coronavirus. We might see numbers increase. It's going to be a long few months ahead, I think, and psychologically demanding for us all. So just pace yourself and just have a plan, I suppose, in your head about how you're going to pace yourself, keep yourself healthy this winter. Exercise is also really important for your immune function. So even in the wintertime, you know, get out for your walk in the evening. Cold air or cold weather doesn't cause the common cold. So just, you know, put on a hat, put on your high-vis gear, get out, go walking, you know, don't stay sedentary for the winter time. Keep moving, keep active. It's so important. And just get out and start making changes now, or make a plan now for how you're going to keep yourself and your family, you know, psychologically and physically robust, and pace yourself for the winter ahead.
Yeah, I think that's such good advice. And it's really good, like you say, to look ahead and plan as opposed to being in the thick of it and looking for a solution. And when patients come to you and they say they're absolutely stressed out of their mind, my GP is very into telling people to get outside and go for a walk or go for a run or go for a swim. Would you echo that?
Completely. I mean, look, movement is so important for our mental health. When we move, the body releases endorphins that mimic the activity of morphine, which is very calming. So movement is so important for our physical and mental health. It helps us to maintain a healthy weight as well, which is also important for our immune system. It also helps us to sleep. So if you actually exercise outdoors, that will help your hormones that are released at night, melatonin. That helps you to get a good night's sleep. When you go outside and you kind of see the sun, that will help your body recognize kind of daytime. So if you get outside during the day, that really does help your sleep. And then, you know, if you can't get outside and you are exercising indoors, that movement is good. It's important as well. You know, tire yourself out. Exercise helps you to get a good night's sleep as well. And then, of course, when you sleep well, then you're, you know, that's so powerful and so therapeutic for your mental health and your physical health. So that, and that all starts with, you know, getting, you know, exercise outdoors if you can. And, you know, that'll help you, you know, have a good night's sleep as well.
Do you think we're far off being prescribed time in nature like they are in Japan?
I wouldn't say so, actually. I mean, I know that some doctors actually do it and actually, you know, prescribe exercise and, like, yeah, prescribing time in nature. And actually, it's something I need to get better at. And it is proven that if we actually prescribe it, like write it down on a piece of paper, that people are more likely to do it than if we just say it, you know, because I think that when we recommend movement or exercise, I think people can sometimes feel dismissed. And that, like, it's not a real thing that we're doing, you know, like it's not a real intervention that a doctor is taking, whereas it feels more like a real intervention if we write it down. So, yeah, you've reminded me now that I need to do that. And me, and I need to start prescribing time in nature as well, because it is so therapeutic. It's so important. And when we do write it down, it is proven that patients are more likely to do it and take it more seriously.
Wow. In terms of checking our breasts as women, when I found my lump, I was 32. I was so shocked, couldn't believe that, you know, I'd been diagnosed with breast cancer at such a young age. But I was really on top of getting my smear test, but I wasn't checking my breasts because to me, breast cancer only happened to women over 50. Should we be checking our breasts as young women?
Absolutely. And I mean, as you say, you know, I think a lot of us, we do neglect it because a lot of the talk about, you know, screening or health promotion amongst women, it does get a lot, you know, diverted to smear tests and cervical screening, because we associate that with younger women as opposed to breast cancer. That's oftentimes associated with older women. So it really is important for us to check our breasts, check for lumps, know your breasts, you know the skin on your breasts as well, know what they look like, you know, knowing what shape and size they are, and looking for any changes whatsoever, feeling for any changes, and it's best to do it in the shower. Know them Don't be I suppose frightened of them. A lot of women oftentimes neglect it because they're frightened of what they might find, you know, but just kind of try to kind of overcome that fear. And if there's any abnormality whatsoever, phone your GP and we'll organise an breast examination. It's important as well, actually, part of breast examination is just feeling under your arm and your armpit. Sometimes lumps in there as well can happen, and your GP will organise breast follow-up. I think that, you know, if there's any change whatsoever, I'll always refer a patient, always, even if I think it's nothing. Mm. I think that both for the patient and for me as the doctor, we both need that this is absolutely nothing to worry about. So I actually often say that to patients, you know, I say, but they come in to me and they say, I've breast lump, but I'm sorry, this is hard for you to talk
no,
about.
No, it's fine. It's so important to talk about this.
Like, if a patient comes in to me with any breast change whatsoever, nipple discharge or skin changes or a lump in their breast or a lump in their armpit, I always say, okay, before I examine you, I'm now letting you know I'm going to be referring you to a breast clinic. So don't take that as a bad message. Oh, no, she's referring me. This is bad news. It isn't. So I say, I'm going to examine you, but I've made up my mind already about what I'm doing. And I think, you know, that would be the approach of most GPs, because we will always get it seen at a specialist centre. And it's so important to follow through and get that done.
I went on a staycation a couple of weeks ago, and before I went on my holidays, I went to my GP for a breast check and to get my bloods done. I was there for another reason, but while I was there, I said, you know, would you mind checking my breasts for me? And she said, of course. So I hopped up on the bed and she asked me how often I check my breasts. And I said, look, it's a really hard thing for me to do. I find it very triggering. Sometimes I have to build up the courage for days to do it. And she said, why not get Jamie to check your breasts for you? And I thought, oh my God, that's a really good way of approaching it. If you are too scared to have an open conversation with your partner, tell them that you're absolutely terrified and ask them to do it for you. And yeah, it really opened my eyes to, I suppose, that you don't have to be alone in those fears, and you don't have to be scared. And it's nice to kind of open up and talk about those sort of things. In terms of smear tests, obviously they are so important to stay on top of. It's really important to make the appointment. But I suppose many people would be under the impression that you don't go into cervical check till you're 25, is it?
Yes.
So should we be getting or encouraging people that we know under the age of 25 to be getting smear tests before then?
There would be some cases in which a smear test would be needed for women under that age. Now, that isn't very common, but, you know, with that said, if you need one before the age of 25, then you'll need one. For example, if a woman has symptoms that could potentially be cervical cancer, we're not going to say, well, let's hang on. You know, obviously that woman needs a smear test there and then. So in some cases, your GP might recommend a smear test to you before age 25 if you have symptoms suggestive of cervical cancer. And then there are a group of women and there are girls out there who just want to get one done earlier than that, because they don't want to wait. And a lot of this comes back to, like, we were speaking at the start about personality type. There are some personalities who will be very anxious about this and they'll want to get a smear test, you know, earlier in life, or they'll want to get one at age 21 because their mum has said that they should do it. And then there'll be a group of women who you know, who aren't anxious about it and aren't, you know, even thinking about it. So if there's, you know, if a woman is anxious about it and wants one before the age of 25, she will have to pay for it. I don't recommend it for asymptomatic women. So if you have, you know, 20-year-old girl who has no symptoms of cervical cancer whatsoever, you know, I don't recommend it. But with that said, if a girl wants one, then I think she should be facilitated in doing that if that's what she wants to do and wants to pay for it. But for most people, screening starting from age 25 for women who don't have symptoms, I think is perfectly acceptable. It's actually not what I think. Actually, those are the international guidelines. Mm-hmm. Yeah, starting at age 25.
I'll get back to that conversation in just a minute. But first, I wanted to tell you a little more about Emma. Made right here in Ireland, the Emma mattress comes with a 10-year guarantee and is delivered for free and straight to your front door. If you're not 100% convinced, you can return it hassle-free for a full refund. Try Europe's most awarded mattress now for 200 risk-free nights and discover the secret to a great night's sleep. The Emma mattress consists of three high-quality foams that perfectly adapt to your body to offer you the right amount of support, pressure relief and comfort, while the breathable materials help keep you cool even during the warmest nights. Just the thing you need to wake up feeling energetic and refreshed. Now, back to the conversation.
When it comes to diet and, you know, often when we go to the GP, we go in because we may have a pain or whatever it is. And you kind of, when you're sitting in the waiting room, you're like, I'm going to ask this and I'm going to ask this. And then you go in and you forget everything. Yeah. But one thing that I never know who to ask the question to is about diet and nutrition. Should we be going privately to see nutritionists and dietitians to get advice on our diet, or is it okay to talk to our GP about it?
I suppose this will depend on your GP, you know, and some GPs might be very interested in dietary advice and very clued in and know what's going on, and then some might not, you know. And I suppose that's the thing about GPs, is that we're all individuals with different personalities and different interests, you know. I mean, for example, I mean, if you come to me with a sports injury, you know, I'm just like, oh God, you know, and I'm just, you know, it's not my strong point and not my forte, and I'll do my best, but I'd be asking some of my colleagues for help or advice about what they would do, and then some of my colleagues are excellent at sports injuries and that's what they do all the time, and you know, they're working with the local sports teams and that's their vibe. So if your GP isn't that into dietary advice and you don't feel like you're getting a lot of, you know, useful or practical advice from your GP, then you could definitely look at speaking with a registered dietitian. So that's really important. So the registered dietitians in Ireland are the people that I would be asking dietary advice for, if you feel that like your GP isn't kind of very clued into dietary advice.
Because I was reading recently that it's actually 7 a day that we should be having portions of fruit and veg and not 5. But I suppose if we're hitting 5 to 7, we're doing a pretty good job, aren't we?
You really are, because I think if that's what you're eating, then and that's what your diet is consisting of, you know, of fresh whole foods, whether it's fruit or veg, that means that you're, you know, not likely to be going to, you know, processed foods and sugary foods and things like that. So I think if you're getting 5 to 7, then your diet is probably looking really good. Yeah.
How often should we be getting our bloods done? Because we hear this, and I think in America they're really good at getting their bloods done. And my oncologist is an American lady called Dr. Jenny Westrup, and she's very forward thinking and she's very into blood work. But should we be making it a priority to do it a certain amount of times a year?
You know, the evidence says that health checks, routine health checks for well healthy people actually don't add any health benefits. Mm-hmm. So there isn't any hard and fast rule with this, because there's no evidence that it will actually benefit you. But with that said, I think getting into the habit or routine of just linking in with your GP, you know, and just, if you don't have a GP, start a relationship with a GP, because a relationship with a GP is so important, that you have somebody that you go to if there's a problem or if something comes up, and then you know somebody, and having that relationship is so important for your health. People who have a GP that they stay with and have a good relationship with live longer than those who don't. So I think that, you know, whilst it's not a hard and fast scientific rule, I think if you want to get your bloods done, even if it was once every 2 or 3 years, and that's just me making up a figure because there's no specific figure, but I think that is a healthy habit, and particularly for men, right? Because women will see the GP because we'll need contraception, or we'll need a smear test, or women will be having babies, or they'll be bringing the children in, or they'll be going for antenatal checks. So women have a lot of reasons to be at their GP even when they're well. So it's a part of our normal life to pop into their GP. But men don't have any of that. So men just don't typically tend to ever be at their GP or go to the GP or have a GP. So I think, you know, if there are any, I suppose mostly it'll be women listening to this, but, you know, for their other halves, you know, to encourage them to get their bloods checked.
And what are you looking for when you're getting your bloods done?
If somebody is very well and they have absolutely, and they come in and they say, look, I feel great. doesn't have a lot, right? But if somebody feels perfectly well and they just want a health check, okay, what'll I do? I'll do like a full blood count, looking at their iron level, and we'll look at the liver and kidneys always. I check vitamin D in my patients as well, because a lot of us are deficient in it. B vitamins, I check vitamin B12 oftentimes, because that can be low for a lot of us who aren't eating a lot of meat. So I'll check the vitamin B12 level. I tend to check celiac screen a lot in patients as well. Not in somebody who's perfectly well, but anybody who has any slight little niggle, I will check for celiac disease oftentimes as well. What else can we can check autoimmune diseases. If anybody's aches and pains, we can check for rheumatoid arthritis. What else can we check for? Diabetes. We can check fasting glucose levels. Checking for diabetes is really important. Fasting cholesterol levels as well. I'll always check for that. Then is there anything else in terms of routine follow-up? Inflammatory markers, I suppose, if somebody has a specific problem. So I suppose those are the routine things that might be done for most people. And then depending if you have a specific problem, more different blood tests can be done.
Well, you can tell so much from a blood test.
It's a good start. And the thing is, you can tell a lot. But at the same time, sometimes we have patients, you know, who there might be a problem and all bloods come back normal. So then you get that situation a lot too. Sometimes they can be very telling and a lot can show up. And then sometimes you're just left with a normal set of bloods and wondering what's going on. You know, it depends on the situation.
And in terms of when you're checking for inflammation and say there's a red flag, does that point to cancer automatically?
It will depend on what the patient is coming with, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you have a patient, for example, who comes with bleeding from their, whether it's vomiting up blood or blood from the back passage or something like that, or abdominal pain or a lump, and then if that's linked with a low blood count in their iron, say if I check the full blood count and the patient has a symptom of cancer associated with a low iron count, that's not good for me, you know, that's a bad sign. So I suppose everything will be so dependent on what the patient has come with, what their complaint is, what their examination is like, and then depending on the blood work as well. So I suppose the most important blood test in that instance and for cancer is probably the full blood count.
And when, I mean, if you Google things, symptoms nowadays, everything points to cancer. But I suppose, what are the signs of cancer? I suppose there's hundreds, I presume.
There are red flags as well. So important red flags to be mindful of, you know, for if a breast lump, any skin changes of the breast, nipple discharge. Then in terms of, you know, lung health, if you know, coughing up blood or an unresolving cough that isn't going away, for cervical cancer, bleeding after intercourse, bleeding between periods, or any unexplained persistent discharge. Those would be red flags for cervical cancer. For bowel cancer, altered bowel habits. So if you would have been somebody who would never have gotten constipated before, or never have had diarrhea before, or blood from the back passage before, any change in bowel habit, it would be a red flag as well. You would need to get that checked out. Weight loss as well. Unexplained weight loss is a sinister symptom that you have to talk to your GP about. And changing moles, again, really important. Any mole that is changing needs to be seen and assessed by your GP. So for changing moles, we use A, B, C, D, E. So like if a mole is asymmetrical, if it has an irregular border, if it has more than two colours, if the diameter is greater than 6 millimetres, or if it evolves or changes, have to get that checked out by your GP, because that could be melanoma. And, you know, that has a real tendency to spread. So, you know, that's the last thing you want with any cancer, is a cancer that has spread. So checking moles is really important as well.
I think it's so scary when, you know, sometimes your mind can go into overdrive and you're worried about this, you know, one particular problem that you may have. And I think the hardest thing to do is make that first appointment and go see your GP and face it. But as we both know, early detection saves lives, and you could save your own life by going to the GP and flagging whatever is wrong as soon as possible.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the time as well, people can dismiss their symptoms or minimise them or say, you know, it must be something else, or it's not serious, or I'll be okay, or, and they'll just put it off and put it off. And people can just be so busy in their lives that, you know, they're working or minding children or minding elderly parents, and they just push and push out the GP appointment. But you just, that first appointment, if there's something wrong, you know, as you say, it could be life-saving, because the key with cancer always is the earlier you detect it, the more treatable it's going to be and the better the survival outcomes will be. So, you know, just make an appointment with your GP and get it checked out.
When do we need to start worrying about our cholesterol and blood pressure? And I mean, I don't know if I've ever checked my cholesterol. I'm 35. Should we be aware of it?
I suppose we should. Now, again, there's no hard and fast rule. You know, there's no, like, you know, for example, sometimes we have really strict rules in medicine. Things are so clear. And, you know, you start screening, it's cervical screening at age 25, and that's black and white, and that's how it goes. But for this particular, I suppose, again, there's no hard and fast rule. But if you were my patient, I'd check your cholesterol. Now, I would, because women oftentimes have higher cholesterol, and it can run in families. I think by age 35, by age 30, yeah. And again, like, I'm making this up because there is no rule for it. Mm-hmm. But again, I think if you're going to your GP for a general health check, most of us will include your fasting cholesterol and get it checked. Yeah.
Is it dangerous when your blood pressure is too high?
Yes, extremely dangerous. So high blood pressure. If you have a high blood pressure that's, you know, not skyrocket high, not, you know, high enough that you would need to go to hospital, but if it's high and you don't know it, that's putting pressure on your heart, you know, and that puts you at increased risk of heart disease, heart attack, and it puts you at increased risk of stroke as well. So high blood pressure is really serious, can put pressure on your kidneys as well, kidney disease. And then I suppose in severe cases, extremely high blood pressure, if somebody comes to me, they might have a headache or a headache at the back of their head, or nosebleeds or blurred vision. That's extremely severely dangerously high blood pressure, and that can put people at risk of bleeds in the brain, you know, which is obviously very serious. So checking your blood pressure at home actually is a good idea, and their blood pressure monitors are widely available in pharmacies. They're not cheap. I mean, I think they're maybe about €100, but a really useful thing actually, I think, to have at home to check your blood pressure.
In terms of men's health, and I know, as we said, that it will be mostly women listening to this podcast, but I wanted to just ask you about two topics in terms of men's health, because maybe the women listening will remind the men in their life to get checked. So when should men be checking their prostate?
So prostate, that's always the, I suppose that's one of the biggest topics when it comes to men's health. And a lot of people ask me about the blood test for prostate cancer, which is the PSA. Now, we don't do PSA blood tests on men who don't have symptoms of prostate cancer, because there's a few reasons. Because I suppose if you're going to do that blood test in somebody who doesn't have symptoms of prostate cancer, you know, it doesn't make sense. So it should only be done in a man who has symptoms of prostate cancer. So symptoms of prostate cancer can be, you know, problems passing urine, you know, interruption of their flow, or any difficulty urinating. So that's when PSA screening or PSA blood test would be done. So it's not a screening test, and I wouldn't encourage any man really to get it done if they don't have symptoms. If a man comes to me getting his routine blood test done, and he feels very well and he doesn't have any symptoms of prostate cancer, I'm not going to put that PSA blood test there. Mm-hmm. Because it should only be done in men who have symptoms of prostate cancer.
Okay. And testicular cancer, can men check their testicles at home?
Absolutely. So again, it's like in the shower, you know, and mm-hmm. just checking to make sure that they know, like, the size and shape of their testicles, and not to be embarrassed about going to your GP with any changes about it. Just come in and get them checked. But from my experience, I think men are actually good at that. They're good at, like, knowing that there is a lump or a change that it needs to get sorted out. So do go into your GP. Don't delay it. Get it sorted out. Any testicular particular pain, or as I said, a lump, any abnormality whatsoever, get it checked with your GP.
Do you think men are getting better at going to the GP?
No, I don't. I don't actually. I rarely, young men still don't come to us a lot. And it's because of that, but for, as I said, for us women, attending the GP kind of is integrated into our normal healthy lives. Like, you know, we're not sick when we're attending for contraception, or we're not sick when we're attending for cervical screening or for pregnancy. So the GP practice or that GP relationship is kind of there as a part of our normal life, but that isn't the case for men. So I mean, and I don't know how, I mean, because I can't get Peter to go to a GP, and he wants me to be, I won't be his GP, I'm just not doing it. So, and I still haven't succeeded. Apparently one of the good ways to get men to go to a GP is to just book the appointment for them. But I don't know how to get men to go to a GP, I really don't.
I think once you have the appointment, you'll go. The hardest part is making the appointment. I suppose we've all been very worried about our kids during COVID-19 and anxiety levels. And, you know, we were all scared going back out into the real world this summer, I think. So if you are a parent and you are a little bit worried about anxiety in your child, should you ring your GP?
Absolutely. Look, we're always there to talk if you're worried about the child, or if there's a change in their behaviour, or if the child doesn't sleep very well, if the child is very anxious and upset about everything that's going on, because they do, they take it all in, you know, and I think children absorb so much more than we realise. So if you're worried about your child, absolutely, because there are services available for children, you know, child psychology services and counselling services for younger people as well, that your GP will be able to link you in with. So definitely it's worth speaking to your GP about it.
And finally, my last question. After you have a baby, often all the attention goes to the baby, keeping this baby alive, keeping the house running, you know, the fridge full, the washing basket empty, and we are just ignoring ourselves. And I think that's what happened to me a little bit when I had Pia. Like, I was always one of these people that said, oh no, I'll be fine, I'll survive. And it never really dawned on me that I should go to the GP for a checkup after I had a baby, or get a breast check. Would you recommend, after having a baby, just kind of checking in with yourself?
Absolutely. And like you described there, I think women oftentimes they themselves almost disappear in a way, you know, because they're putting everything first before they're putting the baby first all the time. So I always make a point of when a woman and baby come in for a 2-week check, I'll start with the woman, you know, obviously, you know, that congratulate a couple on their baby. But, you know, that we start with the health and well-being of the woman herself. You know, how is she doing? How is she coping? You know, and really having discussions as well about your mental health. That is an extremely, really, really, really challenging time for women. And I think there's a pressure on women to, you know, to feel like they have to say everything is perfect and that they're blessed and everything is great. But, you know, you can say that it's tough and that you're having a tough time. So talking about a woman's mental health at those checks, at the 2-week check and at the 6-week check, and then, you know, as you say, just coming in again for a check on your own, you know, without the baby, if it's possible. I know that that's not easy, but a woman's health around that time is so important. And I know that they call you know, the few weeks after the baby is born, you know, the fourth trimester, because mm-hmm. there's so many hormonal changes going on and so many changes at home, and you might be getting less sleep. It's a time of huge change, and it is important to mind yourself, you know, because if women don't mind themselves, they're not going to be able to mind everyone else around them as well. So really just take time for themselves and to mind themselves. And it's not a selfish thing. Women just put themselves last all the time. And it's not selfish just to mind yourself and your own health.
Oh, such amazing advice there. Thank you so much, Dr. Dearan. And I have been reassured so many times when I've gone to my GP, because I think a problem shared is a problem halved, and you'll always feel better after leaving the GP and maybe unloading any worries that you may have. And that's what they're there for. You guys are here to help.
Completely. And look, I suppose from my perspective, when I go to my GP about a problem, I feel then, okay, I've addressed the problem and now it's his problem. And that's what we're there to do, you know. So if you come to me with a problem, I'm now in charge of it, and you know, we'll work together to kind of get through it. But that's what I really like actually about going to my GP. If I have an issue, it's there now and it's for him to deal with, not for me anymore. And that's what your GP is there to do. And even just to chat as well, you know, we're there for that too.
Thank you for your time. I've learned so much from this podcast, and I will be back down to Cork to see you very soon again, please God.
Thanks so much for coming down, Georgie. Lovely to chat to you again.
Thanks for listening to The Good Glow Health with thanks to Emma. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a rating and a review. It would really mean the world. And if you'd like to send me a message about any topics you'd like me to cover, please do so on Instagram at georgie.crawford. Talk to you very soon.